same people will tell you, on the one hand, that ethics is relative, that right and wrong is only what you feel that you are committed to, and in the next breath they'll tell you that they're in favor of universal human rights. Universal human rights. That are the same for everybody, even in places where they aren't recognized. It never occurs to them that they're contradicting themselves. What makes them do that? A single motivation. Get off my back. So if I can keep the government off my back with universal human rights, I use universal rights, human rights. And if I keep my parents off my back by telling them that everybody chooses their own values, I tell my parents that everybody chooses their own values. I'm contradicting myself, it's okay. I just get everybody off my back. Okay, now, today we're going to talk about the difference between Adam and Chava, as they were created, versus what happened afterwards, the condition that we're in. Human being, as we have said, is a soul and a body. The soul and body are quite different. With Satan's device, the whole of the creation into two categories, spiritual and physical. The physically identified as being things that can be perceived. The spiritual not. Now everything that exists is in one category or the other, except man. Inanimate, vegetable, animal life is all animals. Three subjects are all in the physical realm. Angels, certain higher forces are in the spiritual realm. Now, semi-subtle point. Shaded have characteristics of the physical realm and have characteristics of the spiritual realm. So they form a borderline realm. But a shade is one thing. It's one thing which has some physical characteristics and some spiritual characteristics. Man is the only entity that's composed of two other things put together. So, if you are not paying too close attention to your words, you could say a shade is partly physical and partly spiritual, and human being is partly physical and partly spiritual. But the words mean something different in the two cases. In the case of the human being has a physical part and has a spiritual part, and is composed of two parts put together. A shade doesn't have two parts. It's only one thing. But when you describe what kind of thing it's like, it is in some respects like the physical, in some respects like the spiritual. Okay, now, yeah.
But even animals and inanimate objects have some kind of spiritual, like at least a nefesh, you know.
What? Yeah. Nefesh, he says, is the highest physical thing. The life principle of an animal is a physical thing, and it is the thinnest, most ethereal physical thing. I suppose in today's nonsensical pop jargon, you'd call it energy. When you talk about energy, that's the way of mystifying your audience so they don't know what you're talking about. It's all energy, man. Does that mean? I don't know, but it sounds great. Let's have a drink. But we know energy, in strict scientific sense, is physical stuff. Energy has weight. Energy has position. Energy comes in lumps. So, it's all physical stuff. Yeah.
You mentioned shading. Does that mean that they sometimes appear to be physical, sometimes appear to be spiritual, but we don't know exactly which one they are, if they're all one?
No. But we know exactly what they are. They are things that have some physical characteristics and some spiritual characteristics.
In essence, what are they?
They are what they are. They are their own thing.
Are they? But they're not spiritual or physical.
They're not wholly physical, and they're not wholly spiritual. They have some physical characteristics and some spiritual characteristics.
Is there a balance between the two? Or
I have no idea.
One more greater?
I have no idea. And that, I have no idea. I really have no idea. Yeah.
How does this tie into the counterpart, the spiritual counterpart, all things to the physical world?
How does which can't tie in?
Well, you're talking
the
about
physical world.
Yeah, because everything in the physical has a spiritual counterpart, right?
Oh, you're right. I'm used to that. I'm using the word in two different ways. I can't remember how much I told you. I'm not sure the context of it was coming. Look, when you speak about God, you speak about will. That's all we have of him. All the description of his will constitutes him for us. That's all of him there is. That's the one side of the line. On the other side of the line are all the things he created. I'm talking on the second side of the line. I'm only talking about the things that he created. Among the things he created, some are spiritual things and some are physical things and some are like shading, which is a characteristic of both. But what you're probably referring to is when I was talking on the other side of the line, I'm talking about his will, which is all we can describe of him. That's a different, I'm not talking about that at all. That's not our subject. I'm talking about the creation. Okay, now, the soul and the body come from different categories. In a certain sense, it's not at all natural for them to relate to one another. Only in a certain sense, in other areas, yes, it's complicated, but they're really different types of things. God creates an association between the soul and the body. So that what happens in the one is reflected in what happens in the other. In two directions. Someone steps on my toe, I feel a pain. The pain is felt in the soul, even though it's the physical toe that got smashed. I make a decision in my soul, the body's motion usually reflects it, as we said last week. So there's there's an association one with the other, and what happens in one is reflected by what happens in the other. It's that kind of connection. On the other hand, certain differences are preserved in the way they express themselves so that you have symptoms of their essential differences. Let's take an example which applied both to Adam as he was created and to us. Let's consider the differences between action and thought. In particular, let's consider the relationship between action and thought, each of them, and space and time. Let's think for a moment. We're sitting here in Yeshivas Or Sameach in Yerushalayim, May 3rd, 2004. Let's think about New York right now, where it is 8:19 in the morning. Or Los Angeles right now. Or the moon right now. Or the sun right now. Is this getting tiresome? Are you finding it difficult? Further, so let's think about Jupiter right now. Do you have to work up more energy to get as far out as Jupiter? We're going farther and farther away. Somehow, doesn't seem to matter. How far away it is doesn't tax my thought any more than most things. Okay, it's May 3rd, 2004. Let's think about last year, last decade, last century. The destruction of the temple. King David, is it getting harder and harder to think those thoughts? Because they're further and further away in time? Time and space don't matter to thought at all. There are no barriers at all to thought. This is a symptom of the soul. The soul is not in and of itself a physical thing. It's not limited by space and time at all. On the other hand, action, you can only act on something with which your body comes in contact. The surface of your skin is the limit of your action. Beyond that, you can't do? For Adam to eat the fruit from the tree, he had to pick it up with his hand and put it in his mouth. The body is a physical thing. And the soul, which is the source of action, has its ability, its nature, compromised by the fact that it can only act through the body. And therefore, what it does in action is limited by space and time, which is really foreign to its own nature, as is shown by thought, where there's no limitation of space and time on thought whatsoever. You with me so far? Okay, now, here's a symptom of the difference between Adam and us. We are also limited in perception. We can only get information by things that impinge on our surface. Whether I touch something, or sometimes are deceived by cells in the retina, or particles of things float into my nostrils, and I am sensitive to the aroma. Or radiant heat is converted into physical motion of molecules by impinging on my skin. Perception for me is dependent upon the surface of my skin. I can only get information about the world through my skin. Now, Chazal says something fascinating about Adam. Adam could see from one end of the creation to the other. What that means, I mean, what it implies, I'm not exhausting it, but what that implies is that for Adam, perception was like thought, whereas for us, perception is like action. For Adam, perception is like thought, whereas for us, perception is like action. Meaning, for Adam, perception was soul-like. It had the unlimited capacity of the soul. It wasn't bound by space and time. He could see from one, at least by space. He could see from one end to the other. We sit here in this room, the walls of the room bound our vision. Can't see anything else. Not Adam. He could see from one end to the other. So his vision, like his thought, was unbounded by space. For us, vision has become limited by space, just like action is limited by space. So in terms of our ability to get information about the world, we have become more physical than Adam was. This, I think, is a really clear, graphic symptom of what happened. The increased physicalization. Here's a particular area which you can see it directly. An area which for him was soul-like has become for us body-like, which means the body has taken over a certain function from the soul. Okay, so here we have Adam, soul and body, associated with one another. Now, says Ramchal, to associate them at all, you have to reduce some of the capacities of the soul. Because otherwise, the soul and the body couldn't relate to one another at all. Reduce them, I think, means make them inaccessible. Soul is what it is, but when in its association with the body, certain of its abilities, certain of its powers become inaccessible. In our condition, more of a soul is inaccessible, which is shown by the fact that perception no longer is an exercise of the soul, it's an exercise of the body, or limited to by the body. The purpose of reducing the soul's powers is so that it can relate to the body. If in our condition the soul's powers are reduced more than they were originally, it means that we've got a different body, and to relate to this body, more of the soul has to be reduced. But out of touch. Right? These are symptoms of what's going on. Now I'll describe the word.
Yeah. Is prophecy in any way related to perceiving things in the soul?
Yes. Prophecy is an interaction of certain parts of the soul with God. And it makes a big difference what levels of prophecy are available, when they're available, and how they're available. It makes a big difference. The fact that in the last 2,500 years, prophecy has not been available to us is a symptom of a much lower estate. Okay, now.
Yeah. But I don't have prophecy.
Yes.
But then it would seem that he would have known what would happen if he would have eaten from the fruit of the tree, no?
Prophecy does not mean that a person is omniscient. Prophecy means God reveals certain things to him that he wants him to know. No more than that. Now, as I started to say yesterday, Adam was created in a balanced condition. The soul of the body has powers to pull in two directions. That's what enabled him to exercise free will. And it was really balanced. He failed. And the whole creation took a giant step down. If you picture the creation like this, that it had a spiritual level and a physical level. And picture it this way for Adam. When he failed, the whole thing took a giant step down. So that for us, what we call spiritual today was on Adam's physical level. What he called spiritual is out of our view. It's out of our world. We can't relate to it. And a new physical level came into existence, which didn't exist for him at all. The whole creation took a giant step down. So, the body that we have, and the physical world in which we live, is much more powerful, much more fundamental. I'll explain what powerful means in a couple of minutes of the session, than it was for him. The soul then, as we said, for the soul to relate to this new physical, has to be reduced in its capacities. Otherwise, if you try to relate the soul as it was to the new physical, it would simply blow the physical out of the water. It would obliterate it. To work together with it, you know, it's like you have these transformers, right? You can't run on a 220. If you bring a 110 appliance, plug it in over here, it lasts for about 3 seconds. And then it burns out. That's what I've had the experience in a few occasions, not meaning the label correctly. You need a transformer. You transform it down and get a lower voltage. So then, you can make it work. But you've got to transform it down. Here, the soul has to be transformed down. Otherwise, it will simply blow up the body. And since everything took a big step down, the soul has to be lowered even more.
Can we ever reach modern level again? And, I mean, can we actually reach a certain higher level of spiritualness through praying and learning and things like that?
This is a very important question. I'll answer briefly, but underneath this brief answer lies a whole mountain of ideas. Yes, at least on certain occasions, it has been available and even been achieved. Adam, in the Garden of Eden, was not supposed to die. He became mortal by eating the fruit. Now, when the Jewish people came to Mount Sinai, they became immortal again. The verse says, I said you are Elohim, which means like angels, immortal. You're the children of the Most High. We had a chance at Mount Sinai to try again to do what Adam did in the Garden of Eden. Burned the Shemi Shmuel and others. If you read the Mount Sinai story carefully, you'll see that it's a replay of the Garden of Eden. See parallels? So it is conceivable, and it did actually happen in one occasion at least, that we did achieve that level. What to say about people who went alive to heaven and didn't die, also, like Elijah, could also be an indication of that idea. So, there are, as you said at the end, there could be different levels, and you could go more in that direction. Moses went up on Mount Sinai for 40 days and nights, didn't eat or drink. So there also, you have an indication of freeing yourself from the normal trappings of the physical world. So I think you're right. There are levels and gradations of it. And at least on one occasion, the Jewish people accomplished it in total. Yes, it still is in that sense. Yes.
Even after Adam was thrown out of the Garden of Eden, he was on a much higher spiritual level than we are now. Right?
Well, that's a tricky question. I'm not going to answer it. It's a tricky question. It depends on what you mean by higher. It's a very tricky question. He had many more capacities than we have, but the spiritual level isn't defined only by your capacities. Anyway, so what happened? The physical became much stronger. The spiritual was reduced. As I said yesterday, the physical gets a head start. You're born as a body. Your good inclination, the effect of the soul, the existence of the soul and its full powers comes much later. That's why free will only matures much later. According to many, by the way, at 13, you're responsible for your actions in an earthly court. But you're not responsible vis-a-vis God's judgment until you are 20. Which means that there are levels of maturation. There are levels of maturation. Or maybe if you do a mitzvah from 13 to 20, you could be rewarded. But if you do a transgression, you won't be punished. It's also possible. So it takes a long time for the person to regain that balance with which Adam was created. He had the balance at the outset. For us, it takes a long time. That means that the negative side has a much greater advantage. And we're working at a disadvantage. Yeah.
But one who takes responsibility for their actions, whether it's torn thrown out or saw the parents said or teacher.
No, what I'm saying is this.
Right. The
it means that in an earthly court, you will be held responsible and rewarded and punished for what you do. A 13-year-old who commits murder will be executed for that. Nobody does. I mean, the person, the agent is like a person who's not competent. He's not capable of being responsible for what he does.
And also, guys,
can't be punished for a sin before you commit it. That something might be done to a person so it's prevented from coming to do that sin. Yeah.
What about the case of Hagar and Ishmael? Specifically, something could have been done to prevent the entire nation or whatever. Basically, anything that would come against her, any government
who's we?
Being God.
Okay. We're talking about him. As a matter of fact, the Mashiach asks from there a contradiction. Because in Sodom and Gomorrah, we execute him on the grounds that if we leave him around, he's going to commit murder. So Asher says, I will be. What's that?
Never was.
First of all, that's my focus. And second of all, even if so, why would the din be that way? The din is the wrong din. And the answer, Asher says, the difference between what this person will do and what his descendants will do. Ishmael is the case of his descendants. You don't stop somebody now because of what his descendants do. But somebody now, you could stop. Okay, that's my show. Now, what we need to understand is how the change in the world is related to Adam's sin. Here's the first case of sin and punishment. We need to know what is punishment. What's its purpose? How is it related to the sin? Here is an essay in Rav Zestel, which I understand now these essays have been translated. And I would recommend it to you. It's, he has essays on the weekly portions, for some of them, and the portion of Bereishis, first one of the Torah, he explains this idea. What we have to understand is, what was Adam's sin? What did he do? How did he do it? Why did he do it? If we understand that, then we'll be able to see how our condition of the world is crafted to be, in a certain sense, the repair of what he did. Adam is described by our sources as having the evil inclination external to him. That's one idea carried by the serpent. The serpent expresses the idea that the evil inclination is external. Maimonides writes about this in the guide. Now, we have to be very careful here. You can't just put the evil inclination outside and leave it there. Because if you do, when the evil inclination talks to Adam and says, hey, how about this juicy, two-for-one bacon cheeseburger, Adam? Just this week, next week, we're going back to the old press. So, now, if the evil inclination is outside and it speaks to Adam, he's not going to be able to hear it. He's talking to Adam, who hasn't got any natural inclination to do anything about it. It's like offering a person incense from idol worship when his nose is stuffed. What good is it? He can't smell it anyhow. So you can't say that Adam had in him no tendency to fail. Cannot say that. Indeed, what was the point of giving him a soul and a body? So the body should pull him in the wrong direction. So there's got to be some pull in the wrong direction. On the other hand, we do have these sources that say that Adam's evil inclination was external to him. So here's, in simple terms, here's the bottom line. Adam could not perform a sin deliberately. He had no spirit of rebellion. You couldn't attract him by saying, look, Adam, we know it's a cheeseburger, a bacon cheeseburger, and we know that this is really something that God doesn't want, but it's two for one! You couldn't attract him that way. He couldn't do a transgression deliberately, but he could do it if it could be rationalized. If some kind of rationalization could be given that could convince him that it was really right, then he could do it. I'm using the word rationalize purposely because, as most of you hear in the word, often we say rationalization when it's really phony. This is where he can be tempted. He can be tempted to rationalize in a case where the rationalization isn't accurate. That he can be tempted to do. To do it knowingly wrong, that he could not do. Says of Esther, we have to describe Adam as rationalizing what he did. Okay, now how can we do that? Well, God said, don't eat from the tree. Period. Doesn't that make it open and shut? Not necessarily. Because in Jewish law, there is a rule called Horoshah. Horoshah means, on occasion, you can violate an explicit commandment in order to accomplish something that's even more important, even greater. The court can do this. Prophets can do this. They can violate explicit commandments. Violate Shabbos. Violate kashrus. Execute people who aren't guilty of a capital crime.
offer sacrifices outside the temple at a time when the Torah says don't offer sacrifices outside the temple. Elijah did that in the Carmel Mountains. You offered a sacrifice to God at a time when the temple was standing. That's usually forbidden, but in this case an exception was made. It is possible to violate commandments as an exception if something more important, more valuable will be accomplished. So, says the Zohar, Adam, looking at God's commandments, found a rationalization for breaking it on the grounds that by breaking it, he will accomplish something more important, more valuable for God, for God's will, than by simply keeping it. Okay, what is it that he found that would make breaking it more valuable than keeping it? Here's what he said. I'm in a condition now where the evil inclination to do deliberate sins is outside. I'm not capable of a deliberate sin. So if I don't eat from the tree, I'm simply following my nature, the nature that God gave me. How much dedication to God does that show? How much courage in serving God? How much self-sacrifice in serving God does that show? I'm just following my nature, the way He created me. Compare that with the following scenario. I eat once from the tree. I internalize the evil inclination. I change my nature to the point where I am able to deliberately violate God's command. And then I fulfill it. I make it infinitely harder for myself, and then I fulfill it. Will that not be a greater sanctification of God's name? Will that not be a greater act in God's service? It's worthwhile for me to break it once so as to be able to keep it later in a much more spectacular fashion. And of course, Adam has to say to himself, since God gave me understanding of the principles of His will, which include the principle of Harosh Shah, which means a one-time exception, He obviously intended me to figure this out and to use this principle so as to increase the challenge and succeed and thereby create a much more significant sanctification of His name and following His will under much more difficult circumstances. That was Adam's rationalization.
Yeah. Seems to be rationalization already.
Okay, good for you. Good for you. That's the next step. That's the reason. That's the, you know, the logic is there, right? So Odessa then says, that makes me feel like somebody's understanding what I'm doing. Odessa then says, and here, Odessa speaks for the whole Musa school of thought. If a person accepts a false axiom, he can then apply to it perfect logic and end up with a ridiculous conclusion. If his axiom is false, if his starting point is no good. And if a person has an aspect of his character which has not been perfected, that can color his judgment and lead him to accept an axiom which isn't quite true, isn't perfectly accurate. And then when he applies his logic to that axiom, the logic will be perfect, but it's being applied to a faulty axiom, and therefore the conclusion will be an incorrect conclusion. So if that's what it says, what we have to analyze is, where is Adam's character flaw? What axiom did it lead him to accept? See that as the basis of the now rationalization, so we'll understand where the fault lies. And here's where it lies. I'll tell you what Adam said to himself, and then I'll show you how, just by emphasizing the words a little differently, you can see where the fault lies. Here's Adam speaking. If I just don't eat from the tree, so then I'm just following my nature for not eating the tree. And then the obedience to God in the world is trivial. And the sanctification of God's name in the world is trivial. Wouldn't it be a greater sanctification of God's name if I eat from the tree, internalize the Yetzer Hara, and then resist it? Then I will have created a much greater sanctification of God's name. If I don't eat, the sanctification is trivial, and if I do eat, then the sanctification is enormous. That's how he said it to himself. Now, what was the true premise that he was operating on? If I don't eat from the tree and just follow my nature, then the sanctification that I am performing is trivial. But if I eat from the tree and I internalize the Yetzer Hara and I resist, then my sanctification of God's name will be tremendous. In other words, the way Adam portrayed the problem to himself, it was the triviality of the sanctification of God's name. But really, psychologically, what was bothering him was his own triviality. That I will be trivial. What I have accomplished is trivial. What I have done is trivial. Only he clothed it in caring about the success of God's project. What was really driving him was caring about his own spiritual stature. This is the root of Adam's mistake. The failure in his character is anochius, self-interest. But not self-interest for money, not self-interest for power, not self-interest for pleasure, not self-interest for fame. Self-interest in being a spiritual success. This is a very profound idea. You can also already begin to hear echoes of how we live our lives, what we care about. We're so low that if we find a person who's interested in spiritual success, we think he's terrific. We're ready to praise him to the skies. This was Adam's failure. His failure was to be interested in his spiritual success. He should have been interested in God's project only for his own sake. If he had had a rectified character, if he had perfected the place of the anochi, the place of the I, he would have evaluated the difference between following God's command without eating versus following it, eating it and breaking it once and then internalizing it to all the rest. He would have evaluated it very differently. But because he was blinded by the sense of his own spiritual insignificance, that led him to evaluate the two possibilities, following God's command direct, or breaking it once and then following it in worse conditions, evaluated it wrongly, came to the wrong conclusion. So this is Rav Dessler's pattern of analysis, which, as I say, the Musa movement is famous for. It's a character flaw that leads you to accept an assumption, which then, and the assumption isn't quite true, because it isn't quite true, the logic that you apply to it ends up with a false conclusion. This was the software. I was going to talk about how what we do is correct, if I'm going to get that. Yeah?
We keep talking about Adam the whole time, but
Eve, Adam and Chava are one person. Everything, Rambam says something interesting. Everything he says to Chava, to Chava, was true of Adam as well. She saw that the tree was attractive to eat and pleasant to become wise, everything else. All those words apply to Adam as well. They don't apply only to her. Yeah.
And he wasn't perfect.
he was perfectly made to be the kind of creature that could earn its own perfection. That's what he said the whole time, right? It's got to be his. He's got to make it for himself. So you can't give it to him and then have him make it for himself. Right? He's got to be in a position where he could make it for himself. And that's what he was supposed to be. He was made perfectly to do that. It should be a finished perfection, otherwise he can't do that job.
Really, the reason God gave him the command was because he might have gone against it. So there was a possibility that he wasn't like perfect before the sin anyway, because he might have gone against it.
Correct. And in fact, he did go against it. But now you see, this was the real struggle. Where was the struggle meant to be? The struggle was meant to be in evaluating this thought, shall I break it once in order to keep it? Asking himself, where in me does this thought come from? And that source in me, have I perfected that? Is it the way it should be? It's a self-analysis. I definitely won't get to the secret today. Let me tell you a story. Someone came to a Hasidic rabbi and said, I have to marry off my daughter and I need 400 rubles. Now, the rabbi said to himself, just 2 minutes ago, a fellow came in who was deathly ill and then miraculously recovered, and he said to me, I want to thank God for what he did for me. Here's 400 rubles for charity. Now you come in and you ask me for exactly 400 rubles. Yeah, you have to be deaf, dumb, and blind not to see that I'm meant to be a shliach here. I'm just a messenger. He gave me 400, and he's 400. He handed him 400 and said, go, marry your daughter. The guy left. 2 minutes later, he calls his gabbai, his private secretary, says, go find that guy and bring him back. Finds him, brings him back. Says to the guy, put the 400 rubles on the table. Go out. Goes out. A couple of hours later, the Rebbe calls him back in, gives him the 400 rubles, says, go, marry your daughter. Okay, he's happy to go with the 400 rubles, looking over his shoulder, you know, am I going to make it this time? The gabbai says to the Rebbe, what happened over here? You gave it to him, you called it back, you gave it to him again. So, the Rebbe said like this, I gave it to him. As he walked out, I began to think to myself, is that right? That I should give all 400 rubles to one person? Couldn't I break it up into 20 packages of 20 and use it to benefit a lot of people? Maybe the marginal utility of money, those who study economics, you know, increases the value of the money to give it in smaller packages. And then he said, I realized that one of these thoughts came from my good inclination, and one of these thoughts came from my evil inclination, and it was my job to figure out which is which. That's when I called them back and had the money put on the table. Now listen, boys and girls, one thought was to give the 400 to this one guy. The other thought was to give away 20 packages of 20. We're not talking about holding it and investing in AT&T and taking the profits off the top. Yet, he said, one came from the good side and one came from the bad side, and his job was to figure out which is which. Fine. So then the gabbai said, "Nu, how did you figure it out?" Now listen to the answer. I don't know if you can relate to this. If you can't, put it in your memory bank. Maybe someday you will be able to relate it. He said, the second thought came to me as follows. Don't give the money to one person, give it to 20 people. And I realized, any thought that comes in the clothing, don't give it to him. Even if it continues with, rather give it to them, it's coming from the wrong side. Because its source is in a don't give, it's coming from the wrong side. In other words, don't look only externally at the consequences of your action. Look internally. Where in me is this coming from? What side of me is talking? What part of me is talking? Realize that when you perform an action, whatever part of you is the springboard for that action is going to be reinforced by the action. You're going to make it stronger. Actions have consequences in two directions. They have consequences externally and the consequences internally. Part of your evaluation for an action should be, where does it come from in me, and what will it do to me and for me if I perform this action? William James said that every day he tries to do something irritating. Irritating to himself. Because the ability to do something irritating is like a muscle, and you have to keep it well exercised. Otherwise, when you really need to do something irritating, you won't be able to do it. Building yourself to your actions is in some ways as important as the external effect of your actions. Now, in this sense, it's all Muslim. And I quoted a non-Jew there purposely because it shows you that non-Jews also have this wisdom from time to time. Now, says of Zestra, Adam should have, or at least should have carried it to completion, asked himself, I'm making a calculation. Where in me does this calculation come from? What part of me? Have I ever addressed that part of me? Am I sure that that part of me is perfect? If I'm going to undertake to violate a command for the sake of a bigger payoff in God's name, I have to be sure that the way I evaluate the options is accurate. If it comes from a part of me that isn't perfected, that isn't perfect, then I have to be doubtful that I'm getting the right evaluation. And here, he indeed had the wrong evaluation, made the wrong decision. So this is the explanation of his failure. Tomorrow we have to see how lowering the world in the way in which it's lowered is the right response to rectify that failure.